We are fortunate here, being on the campus of the University of Illinois, we get to draw on various kinds of talks by people who come here to the campus. It's been a rich source of guests for us. And one of the series that's been going on now since last fall is a series taking a look at the changing role of the university. And much of this has looked at the meaning of the relationships, and we see more and more of them all the time, between corporations and universities. It's a series that's sponsored primarily by the Center for Advanced Study. There are a lot of other sponsors as well. I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but there are too many to mention. And there'll be another of these talks today, and we're fortunate to have here in studio with us the speaker. So we do these things to try to bring them to a larger audience outside of the campus area here in Champaign-Urbana. The guest is Michael Hansen. He's a research associate with the Consumer Policy Institute, which is a division of Consumers Union. That's the organization that publishes Consumer Reports magazine. And his field of interest is biotechnology. He's the author of Biotechnology and Milk, Benefit or Threat, which was published in 1990. He's been largely responsible for developing the Consumers Union's positions on safety, testing, and labeling of genetically engineered food. And he is here to talk about what this relationship between the university and corporations has to do with biotechnology research. We'll explore it in some depth, but essentially the argument he makes is that the increasing involvement of corporations with universities in their research means that the profit motive is the number one thing. That's what you were thinking about, and that's what drives research. And perhaps not so much what would be good for humanity, but what's going to make money. So we'll talk about this and perhaps get into some other issues as well. And your questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can join the conversation. Just a couple more things about our guest. He's also written reports for the Consumer Policy Institute and Consumers Union on other issues, including household pest control, alternatives to agricultural pesticides in developing countries, and also the pesticide and agriculture policies of the World Bank and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. He's a graduate of Northwestern University, has a doctorate in ecology and evolutionary biology from University of Michigan, and did postgrad study at University of Kentucky on the impacts of biotechnology on agricultural research. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I guess I gave the headline. Maybe we can talk in a little bit more detail about the argument that you're making. Perhaps we can also give some examples that increasingly, as more and more, as these partnerships become more common between corporations and universities, that it is, the bottom line is, whatever research is done, is this going to make money or not?
Right. You're seeing these increasing university-industry connections, and it's coming to the point that a lot of universities see they are almost viewing themselves as businesses. I think the most recent deal that has particularly troubled people is at the University of California. One whole division in the College of Natural Resources at the University of California at Berkeley, Novartis, had paid $25 million to the university in exchange. What they'll get is they will get access to 30-40% of all the inventions that come out of this department at Berkeley, regardless of whether Novartis funded them or not. So you have one corporation actually having straight direct ties with one university, with an entire department. That raises questions of will work that it is not profitable still be done? Will work that's in the public interest be done? And that deal has already gone through. What they're talking about now, which is even more controversial, is for the University of California-wide system, they're talking about setting up three of these genomic or centers to the tune of $300 million, of which $100 million would come from the state and $200 million would come from the private sector. The problem with these increased government industry interactions, at least in the area of biotechnology, is I think that the general public, who used to look for universities as neutral sources of information, they don't perceive that now anymore. They perceive most universities as being proponents of this technology because of their connections with these companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what should it necessarily be the case that research that is profitable, why can't research that's profitable also be in the public interest, something that has a general public good? I mean, do we immediately assume that those two things can't go together?
No, not at all. I think that it is good to try to take work that is done at basic science institutions and get that out to the general public in the form of technology. What's disturbing with these university industry connections is now you're starting to see scientists who are doing work in certain areas functionally being in a conflict of interest, having an economic stake in some of the work they're doing, that if their research turns out positive, they might make themselves millions of dollars. So they're no longer the disinterested academic. And in fact, studies have shown over and over that many folks at these universities have these financial conflicts, and they're not being reported, either to their, sometimes not to their universities, but very frequently not to people, not to journals where they publish articles in. So if you look in medical journals and you see an article which says that a certain drug is good, you might not know that that author has gotten large sums of money from the drug company.
Hmm.
And if you knew that, you might then take their research more with a grain of salt because they have an economic interest in it. So you're getting away from the science is supposed to be about the dispassionate search for truth and looking at information. Once people start to have financial ties, it can cloud things in ways they don't even realize. Because most of the scientists will say, well, just because I'm making a bunch of money, that's not going to impede any of my science. I will still do just as good science as before. They even get offended that you might suggest that that the economic motivation might influence what they do. But there are a number of studies out there in the literature that clearly show that those conflicts of interest do have an impact. So you can look at studies that have been done, for example, where they look at drugs, certain drugs for diseases, and then they look at all the articles that come out over a two-year period, look at hundreds of them, and then classify the authors as either connected to the industry, having financial connections, or neutral, and you can look and see the papers that they do, and you'll see that folks that do have an economic interest or work for have contracts with a company, their articles tend to be much more positive about those drugs than somebody who's not getting money. And this has been done with large enough sample sizes that you can show that these are statistically significant results. So the data do in fact show that money can influence, and it's just gotten to be so pervasive that that it really raises questions not only about the university and industry connections, but even at the government level as well. Because on a lot of federal committees, there's, for example, conflict of interest guidelines saying that if you're going to sit on a committee of the Food and Drug Administration, you have to disclose all your financial conflicts. It used to be that if you had a direct financial interest, they wouldn't let you on one of these committees. Now, research is showing that they're routinely granting waivers of exemptions. USA Today just last year did a study where they looked at all the FDA advisory committees that met between June 1st, 98 and June 30th, 1999. No, I'm sorry, June 30th, 2000, right? Mm-hmm. And there were 159 committees. What they found is that at 92% of those meetings, at least one member had a financial conflict of interest. 92% of the meetings. If you look at 55% of the meetings, over half of the advisors had a conflict of interest. If you look at the meetings where they were talking about broader issues, about how you regulate, like what should be on warning labels, these sort of broader issues, 92% had conflicts. That means, by the narrow definition of the Food and Drug Administration, they have an economic interest in the topic under discussion. And yet the FDA is allowing these people to sit on these committees. And just in that year and a half process, over 800 times they waived those conflict of interest regulations. And one that was even talked about was a case with a antibiotic that Johnson & Johnson was trying to put through. And it turns out the person that was on the FDA committee, who was the consumer representative, supposed to be representing the consumer at large, turned out it was somebody who helped design the drug trials for Johnson & Johnson and had a long history of being a consultant with him. That was the consumer representative on the panel? I mean, that's...
Let me, at this point, probably I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Michael Hansen, a research associate with the Consumer Policy Institute, which is a division of Consumers Union. Those are the folks that publish Consumer Reports magazine. He currently works on biotechnology issues. He's here in Champaign-Urbana visiting the university. He'll be giving a talk on this very topic, looking at university corporate relations and the effect of those relations on biotechnology research. Part of a continuing series looking at the university's changing role. And for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be giving his talk at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the auditorium of the Law Building at the College of Law on the U of I campus. And that's free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So anybody who wants to stop by and hear more from him, you can do that. And here, of course, your questions and comments are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I wonder if you can answer this question, and that is how over time the proportion of funds that come from government and from private business has changed. Because it's my assumption that there would have been a time, I don't know how long in the past, but there would have been a time when more money for the kind of research that we're talking about came from government, from federal government, from the state government, and less from private business, and that has shifted dramatically, and now more money comes from private business than comes from government. But I guess I'm just kind of wondering if you can talk sort of somewhat specifically about that, Ben.
Right. For the corporate giving, I think things need to get tied to, there were two key regulatory actions that happened. One was in 1980, and that was the passage in Congress of the Bayh-Dole Act. And the Bayh-Dole Act was the one that for the first time allowed universities to patent the results of federally funded research. Before that, any research that was done in the public universities with public funds couldn't be patented for private benefit by the universities. It had to be freely available to the public at large. That changed in 1980, and that was when you then started to see a movement toward more corporate money coming in. But even more important than the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980, in 1985 you had the Federal Technology Transfer Act, and that's what mandated the setting up of these, they're called CRADAs, Cooperative Research and Development Agreements, where they actually pushed NIH and the government to start in their funding to basically fund these sort of joint ventures. If there looked like there was research being done in a lab which could be commercialized, then it was saying that it was okay to set up these cooperative research and development agreements. It was at that point that individual scientists that were working for the government or in academia could now sort of set up companies and literally make millions of dollars. What we've seen since then is in 1985, corporate giving to academia was $850 million. About 10 years later, in the mid-90s, it was $4.25 billion. So there's been, that's a five-fold increase in less than 10 years. And in general, I do know that there is declining federal funds going into the land grants. That's typical what's called hatch grant funding. The funding for agricultural research has functionally stayed stable in the United States or declined, whereas the corporate money has gone up. Let's see. From 1980 to 1998, funding for academic research that corporations did expanded at the rate of 8.1%. That's $1.9 billion in 1997, and that's nearly eight times the level of 1980.
Okay, we have a couple of callers. We have somebody on the cell phone, so we'll get right to them. Line number four. Hello?
Yes, I totally agree that what you're saying about the corporation's infiltration into the research, although I think that in academia, although if you look back historically, we notice that the University of Chicago and a number of other prestigious places today were infiltrated with corporate funds and still are. And I think that we know that government and government officials are infiltrated with corporate money. Money just unfortunately has a way of infiltrating in all areas. And I don't know if this is something that is such a big trend that we can stop or alter, but I do know that in another sense that a lot of these scientists that maybe do these studies of course want more grants, but then again in another sense they want to be respected as a true scientific person that has important data and does important studies that among their colleagues. So I think that you're absolutely right about the corporate, invasion of science to some extent. But the bottom line comes if the results aren't there, and it can be proved consistently that these things don't hold up, even though some studies are definitely slanted and tweaked it to some extent. But in an extensive evaluation of these studies, often the true scientists know what is right and what is wrong and what is correct, and I think sometimes they're winking at the at corporations, providing them with certain kinds of studies, but everybody knows that they are they're weak as water, so to speak. So anyway, that's in my comments. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure.
Well, I sort of agree with some of the things you said, but while it is true that the University of Chicago and others have been getting corporate money, I think the difference in the field of more general biology is that really wasn't the case 30 or 40 years ago. 30 or 40 years ago, in fact, people would be looked down on if they would be working on things that had an economic impact, because you were seen as then you're not interested in doing the research for the sake of the knowledge, you're interested in doing it for grubby monetary concerns. And I think, you know, Jonas Salk was once asked about patenting the polio vaccine, and he thought it was a crazy idea. He looked and sort of said, would you patent the sun? So there really has been a sea change, I think, in the sort of mindset of a lot of young researchers. Nobody now seems to bat an eye with doing research at the university that then will lead to you setting up a company that will make you millions of dollars overnight. Nobody seems to think that there's anything wrong with that, whereas 30 years ago, that would be unthinkable. An academic who tried to do that would be shunned by many of their colleagues, and that just has dramatically changed as all this money has come flooding into the life sciences.
Well, to take the devil's advocate, I agree with what you're saying in essence and in some respects, but capitalism doesn't work unless the customer is satisfied and real products are developed that are of real need, and I think you know, what you're saying is correct, but I think in another sense, capitalism in its slow process weeds out these things that are imitations and weeds out things that are really not important breakthroughs eventually.
Well, yes and no. If you look, capitalism does do a number of wonderful things, but we do have a whole PR industry. And there's wide ranges of products out there that really don't have much usefulness, but with enough PR, you can convince people that they need it. The other problem that I actually see is it's an opportunity cost. It's all this money is going into certain areas where more money can be made because that's what the market is good at. But the kind of research which is truly in the public interest and that the market can't supply, that's what should be doing. That's the kind of research that our public universities should be doing. And they're increasingly not doing that. A perfect example is if you look at the field of classical biological control. That's where you have an insect pest, and it actually, the reason it's a pest is it's not native, for example, to the United States. It comes from some other country and is now causing problems here. With the classical biological control, what you do is you understand the biology of that pest. You go to where it's where it normally comes from. You find the other insects or other organisms which naturally control it, and you bring it back and release it. So a perfect example is over 100 years ago in California, in the late 1880s, the citrus industry was on the verge of collapse. The reason was for a little insect called the cottony cushion scale. They tried at that time, the pesticides they had weren't working, and the citrus industry was faced with basically collapse. Well, what the university did is they sent a scientist over. He went to Australia. He found, because that's where the cottony cushion scale comes from, and he found one of a series of predators, but particularly the Vidalia beetle, brought that back to California, and when he released those beetles, they spread by themselves, naturally controlling the cottony cushion scale, thereby saving the citrus industry. And they've been saved ever since, because once you released that natural enemy, it naturally controls the pest, and so you don't need to come back and do anything more. Now, that's a classic example of classical biological control. That's something that the market can never, ever produce. And the reason for that is in economic terms, what a classical biological control agent is, it's a product that destroys its own market. Because even if you come up with this great insect, once you release it and it spreads by itself, well, you can only make one or two sales. Classical biological control has done wonderful things in the U.S. and many other countries. And yet at the University of California, the Division of Biological Control, which was started almost 100 years ago, was the premier one in the world. That has now been shut down. And instead, they're doing a lot of genetic engineering work. So there's an example of the kind of research which is not being done, or research looking into agricultural ecology, the ecological relationships between pests and plants and their and environment. Lots of that kind of research doesn't yield any kind of product that can be sold or patented, but it can lead to knowledge which is useful and in the public interest, but is not something that the market can provide. So while I think that there are many useful things that the market can do, part of what public sector research has to do is look at those areas that the market can't supply and find out things that are in the public interest and do that. And by increasingly focusing on these for-profit things, what you have is a lot of scientists working on areas that will potentially make them a whole bunch of money. And their graduate students then become people that are whose work is will ultimately serve a for-profit. And while some of that isn't bad, where is the general public sector research that is in the interest of the public at large, but is something that doesn't necessarily generate a product to which you can get a profit?
We are at our midpoint. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have somebody else we'll get right to in just a moment. I want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Hansen. He's research associate with the Consumer Policy Institute, a division of Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports magazine. He works on biotechnology issues. He has worked on developing the Consumers Union positions on genetically engineered food. He's also written reports for the Consumer Policy Institute and Consumers Union on pest control, both for the household and in agriculture. And he's here to talk about this very subject, relations between universities and corporations, and what that means for biotechnology research. He's going to be talking on this topic this afternoon on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock at the auditorium of the law building. So anybody who's around Champaign-Urbana can hear what he has to say. And here on the program, if you have questions, you may call 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. There's a caller in Atlanta, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
This little discussion here might be a little bit irrelevant, but I think, or at least might be off the topic, but maybe relevant. I was on a long-distance train trip this summer and happened to have lunch with a lawyer from the Department of Agriculture. And what his job was he would litigate against or bring to prosecution people that were violating food safety issues, particularly in the packing industry and importing industry. And one of his really, really scary comments, which is where my question leads, is if the new our conversation went to the impending election, and he said, you know, that he was really fearful that if the administration changed, that, you know, it was barely enough money in the Agriculture Department funded for food safety as it was, particularly to do the testing. And he thought with the new administration coming in that it would be absolutely a nightmare that, again, that the large companies would be able to kind of run unabated in that area. Would the guest have any comment on that conversation?
Yes, I actually know some people that do similar kind of work, and they're just as concerned as you say they are. Part of the problem with some of the food safety work is I know that since USDA, they actually control the meat and poultry supply. They're responsible for its safety. They're in this whole process of they want to get away from inspections where you have physical government inspectors inspecting in some of these plants, and they're proposing to do pilot projects where the companies themselves will self-monitor with just a little oversight done from the federal government. And there are some people that have a lot of concerns about allowing the companies to self-regulate themselves on the safety area. So
my concerns were justified from that conversation, and that lawyer's concerns were probably accurate.
Yes, and there's also just the general consideration of there has actually been a huge increase with this globalization of all sorts of food and food products crossing our shores. And if you look at the USDA, and then the Food and Drug Administration is also supposed to be doing testing. They're not doing any more testing of foreign food items that are coming in, and yet we've had this dramatic increase in trade. So more things are crossing our borders from overseas, and lesser percentages of them are being tested. So that raises potential concerns as well.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just again, to be devil's advocate, going back to some of the comments you made earlier, particularly in conversation with the other caller, there is precedent in hard sciences for researchers who work at universities to benefit economically from their work. And I guess I'm not quite sure why it should be a problem for people in the life sciences to do that, and whether we should expect them to, you know, as they're sitting in their offices, they're looking across the campus at their colleagues who work in areas like electrical engineering, for example, and computers, and they see them making lots of money from spin-offs from their research. I mean, why should we say that people in life sciences shouldn't also be able to do that, or anybody shouldn't be able to do that?
Well, there is actually, if you want to look at that, there are some people who have questioned some of the kind of patents that are being allowed on software. But electrical engineering, I mean, I don't know those fields as much, so I don't know what kind of money we're talking about. Mm. But I can tell you in the life sciences now, I mean, you're talking about people setting up companies and literally making tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars on their own research. And I just think that is a different order of magnitude that then draws people into basically chasing the money. And I think in the life sciences, the potential downside for that is when you're looking at agricultural science, you might decide to pursue, which I think they are, a high-tech genetic engineering approach and all this sort of more sustainable, ecologically based approaches are being ignored or actually giving, they are getting some money from the government, but it's a pittance. It's less than 1% of, you know, total ag funding. So it's really small amounts to do this sustainable work. And I guess I haven't seen in engineering, although someone might want to call in and correct me, but whereas in some ways as much damage can be done. Because with life sciences, when you're talking about medicine, that's where it's been looked at the most. I mean, it's gotten to the point that these connections between doctors and drug companies have really gotten out of hand. I mean, it's to the point that they're people that whose names occur on publications who didn't write them. They're paid a sum, and this stuff is ghostwritten by a paid public relations professional by one of the companies, and then they get some scientist for $5,000 or $8,000 to literally review it and then put their name on the top. So you have all this ghostwriting and all these things happening with medicine where when you're talking about drugs that they want to approve that can have an effect on people's lives, then you can start talking about negative outcomes. There is the case a couple years ago with the calcium channel blockers, and that was work that was people had touted these calcium channel blockers as being great in the early 90s, and then there was new studies coming out showing that there was a risk of heart attack and I think stroke in certain portions of the population. Those people had to fight to get those studies published. After all the debate was come and gone, there was an analysis done in the Journal of the New England Journal of Medicine, and what they found was that 96 authors who supported the use of these antagonists had financial relationships with the manufacturers. Yeah, the authors who supported the use of them, 96% of the authors who supported the use of these channel blockers were getting money from the drug companies compared to 37% of people that were critical. And this was a study that was done, was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998, and it clearly shows that there's a strong association between an author's published position on the safety of those drugs and their financial relationship with the pharmaceutical manufacturer. It should be pointed out that this study, I think, looked at about 70 studies, and in none of them they found were those financial conflicts revealed in the publication. So this article argues that you have to have full disclosure. So when you're talking about drugs and other things, you can potentially cause harm. We knew that there were drugs put on the market that supposed science said they were fine, like this diet drug Fen-Phen. And then a couple years later, oops, it's showing us that it's not good and we have to pull it off. Well, when you start to realize that people that are writing good things about these drugs are getting money from the manufacturers, that doesn't necessarily bias the research that gets done, but it's something that definitely needs to be taken into account. Because if you look at research, for example, that suggests that secondhand tobacco smoke isn't a problem, if it's being funded by the tobacco companies, you tend to take that with a much larger grain of salt than if it's by a researcher who has no connection at all to the company. And I think the average person on the street realizes that the appearance of conflict is important, because if you have an economic interest in some kind of result, then you can't really be considered to be completely neutral on it. That's why at Consumers Union, for example, we publish Consumer Reports, we have very strict policy. We can have no connection with the for-profit. We cannot accept gifts or anything. And the reason for that is somewhere down the road, we might have to test one of those companies' products. And if we accepted a gift, or if I traveled to a meeting, even to criticize a company, if they paid for it down the road, if we test something of theirs and we give it a good rating, people might say, well, did you do that because you literally thought that was the best? Or could the fact that you've gotten this money 4 years ago influenced you. Mm-hmm. That's why Consumers Union has a completely strict policy. Well, academia and other folks don't. And they'll argue, these scientists who are making millions of dollars, they'll argue that they don't see any conflict, that no, this would never interfere with their science, but yet when you look at the research that gets done in technical publications, you see that it does influence.
Well, here, and I know at the University of Illinois, for example, there is, I mean, even we are required every year to fill out a form to disclose any conflicts that, that we might have. But it sounds as if you're suggesting that one of the best ways to make this clear would be for the publications that publish the research papers, the journals and so forth, that they, you would say that that should be required in a very clear way right there on the paper if there is a conflict that of the author, it should be.
Absolutely. Later. And in fact, the New England Journal of Medicine has some of the strictest policies. They, for example, require full disclosure, and they've taken it a step further. They've said that for editorials that are written about drugs or other products, they will not allow anyone to write an editorial that has any financial connection to the company in who makes the drugs that are being talked about in the review article. Now, they've actually, even though they have the strictest policy, they've fallen down on that a number of times. One example that I'll tell you about is in 1996, the New England Journal published, there was a book that came out called Living Downstream, and it was by Sandra Steingraber, and it's a cancer survivor's look at the whole issue, and she, of course, focuses on a lot of environmental and other concerns. Well, there was a review of that article of that book that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, which slammed it and said that this is hysterical, et cetera, et cetera. The author was given as Ronald, I think his name was Burke, B-E-R-K-E, and he was just identified as an MD or an M or Masters of Public Health. What they didn't reveal was that he worked for W.R. Grace, which of course is a big company that produces lots of toxic chemicals, which have polluted the waterways, and in fact, they're infamous because in Woburn, Massachusetts, there was a book written about and a movie made called A Civil Action about where W.R. Grace, by releasing some of their chemicals, actually had to pay a gigantic fine for poisoning the groundwater and then trying to hide that information from the Environmental Protection Agency. This was happening literally in the New England Journal of Medicine's backyard. And their explanation was for this Burke, we initially realized that this person worked for W.R. Grace, but we didn't really know that they did all this chemical stuff. Well, the problem with that was is W.R. Grace's headquarters are in Boston, which is where the New England Journal of Medicine, where the editors actually live in Cambridge, and it was all over in the papers there. And Woburn, Massachusetts, which that was all over the papers 10 years ago, and then when the movie with John Travolta came out, it was all over the papers there as well, and they claim they didn't know.
So. We have about 10 minutes left here. I have a couple of other callers we want to get to. Again, our guest this morning, Dr. Michael Hansen. He's a research associate with the Consumer Policy Institute, which is a division of Consumers Union. He's here to talk on the U of I campus about biotechnology research and how directions in research are affected by the relationship between universities and corporations that fund a lot of that research. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Have a couple Urbana callers here. First is line number two. Hello?
Yes? It seems to me that the classic example of industry-funded research is the research done by the American Heart Association for maybe 30 years, which seemed to confirm that hydrogenated vegetable fats were much better for you than animal fats. But when independent research was done, they were found to be just as damaging to your health, perhaps more so. And of course, all of that research was funded by the vegetable fat industry, particularly the margarine makers.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely correct. That's a perfect example.
And it went on for, 20 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have to look. That's an increasing example of where you're seeing some of these nonprofits, so-called nonprofits, mm-hmm. the American Heart Association, other ones, are starting now to have these connections with industry. And that's also, I find, a little bit troubling as well.
And I don't think the researcher necessarily has to be, certainly not criminally inclined, but even trying to distort the facts. It's simply that the research is focused to get the right result. There's just too much pressure on the researcher when the money's all coming from one source.
Yes, and I think there's also pressure, and it can be unconscious, where not only is the money might be coming from one source or predominantly, but when you have scientists that can set up their own companies so that some of their research might end up, if it's on some product, they might end up having the company that sells it, and so they might stand to make millions, tens of millions, or I've seen cases where people have made over $100 million. And when you're talking about those sums of money, then that's even more pressure than I think just getting funding from a corporate source. When you yourself can start making large sums of money on your own research, that can have an effect as well.
I think you're right. Another area that's been very disturbing to me is in agricultural research. The money comes from the large machinery manufacturers and the chemical manufacturers. Virtually no research is done for organic farming or even farming that is focused on the small to medium-sized producer, and I consider in this area 1,000 acres to be medium or small. It's all focused toward the type of producer who will buy the biggest machinery and use the most chemicals.
That's actually correct, but you're starting to see, because of pressure from the other side, that's starting to change. Minor, but there is funding. The USDA does have a program. It's called the SARAP program, which is for these alternative agriculture, sustainable ag, organic and medium farms, but it's minuscule. It's, I think, $1.5 million a year. Or no, actually, I think the SARAP program is up to maybe about $5 million a year, which is minuscule when you compare it to how much other money that is being spent. But yes, that is one of the problems with agricultural research. In fact, there was a lawsuit in the 70s that went against the University of California system for the development of the mechanical tomato harvester. And what they were arguing is if you go back and you look at the enabling legislation, the Hatch Grant and the Morrell Acts from the late 1800s that set up the land-grant universities, they actually were set up in opposition to the elite private universities, and the idea behind them was to offer education to the broad masses of people and to do research that was in the public interest, in the interest of everyone, not just in the interest of the elite few. And unfortunately, what's happened in the ag area is all the research has sort of funneled toward the largest of the large and those folks. And there is more pressure to reverse that, and I think that is starting to happen, but it's at the margins, and it is picking up, but not nearly as quickly as it needs to.
Interesting. The last yearbook of agriculture brought out in the Carter administration by Secretary Freeman found that medium and smallest producers were as efficient. As soon as Reagan got in, his new Secretary of Agriculture stopped distribution of those books and destroyed any that were left, as I understand it. I know he stopped distribution.
Actually, you're correct there. And what's really interesting is the data is always consistent. If you look at the medium and smaller size farm, they are more efficient on just a production of crops per unit area. The larger farms aren't as efficient, but of course, since they have larger areas and acreage, they can ultimately make more money. But if you want to look just at the strict economics and what's most economically rational, it is the small and medium-sized farms.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in here, because we just have a couple of minutes left, and I do have one other person I'd like to try to include. So let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line number 3. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I just think somebody should say thank you to your speaker. I wish I could come and hear your lecture, but I'm a miserably crippled 85-year-old woman, and I appreciate so much the work you're doing, and I also think I'm speaking for many others like me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I will say I have been told if you have a computer, I think they're going to webcast it as well, so you should be able to get access to it, either as it's happening or afterwards, because I have been told that I'm not going to use any slides or pictures, and they told me that's better because it's easier to webcast that way.
Well, thank you very much for your work.
All right, thanks for the call. It costs a lot of money to do scientific research, and the government is obviously not providing adequate funds. Researchers have to go somewhere to get the money, so they're going to the private sector. If the government's not going to provide the money, then what choice do researchers have?
Well, I do think that the government needs to provide more money for research that's in the public interest, but I also think it's up to the universities. While it's okay for individual scientists to look and to maybe try to get some funding from corporate or other sources, the fact that it's happening on such a large scale and that the universities themselves are going this area, that's what's troubling, is that they themselves are deciding on a university-wide basis that we want more of this and less of the kind of research which doesn't bring in money, no matter how good it is. I mean, you're starting to see in some of these universities, they are deciding on the East Coast, well, maybe to shut down some of the humanities and other departments because they're not bringing in money. And that's just the wrong way to go when you have folks running the universities who are starting to see the universities almost like a business and figure out ways they can make money with their patents and other things, then the whole mission of the university starts to change. It would be one thing if there were a few scientists going outside to try to get this money, if the people that run the university still kept the public interest at heart and were very sort of critical and set up all sorts of stringent requirements for disclosure and everything, but they're not doing that. They seem to be running to embrace some of the higher tech stuff as ways of generating funds, and that's what's even more problematical, that it's happening at the highest levels of the university.
We are going to have to stop at this point because we're at the end of the time. For anyone here in and around Champaign-Urbana, however, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Michael Hansen, on the subject, he'll be talking at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the auditorium of the Law Building of the College of Law on Pennsylvania in Urbana. And anyone who's interested in hearing more on the subject about the relations between universities and corporations and what that means for biotechnology research, they are welcome to stop by. This is part of a continuing series looking at the changing role of the university. Our guest, Michael Hansen, research associate with the Consumer Policy Institute, which is a division of Consumers Union. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.